I'd like now to welcome to the program Lenny Combe. He's campaign director at Appalachian Voices, and he'll be giving a multimedia presentation called Appalachian Treasures. That's tomorrow on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th at 4 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. It's a free event co-sponsored by the Santa Fe Watershed Association, the Santa Fe Art Institute, and Little Globe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about that thing that you will be talking about, namely mountaintop removal. Where are you located, and what are you seeing firsthand in terms of this kind of very destructive coal mining?
Well, our main office is in Boone, North Carolina, which is about 75 miles as the crow flies from the nearest mountaintop removal coal mine in West Virginia. That sort of mining in Appalachia goes on in southern West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, and northeast Tennessee and the very southwest corner of the state of Virginia. And that's what it is, the coal industry about 20 years ago discovered that it was much cheaper to mine coal rather than by digging tunnels, the traditional method of coal mining, that they just blow off the top of a mountain in stages to, from one seam of coal to the next, and push all the waste and rubble into the valleys which contain the stream beds. And so far they have destroyed over 500 mountains and covered up 2,000 miles of stream beds in Appalachia.
So the environmental effects of that, in terms of how people are living their daily lives, their water supply, and so on, must be absolutely gigantic.
Oh, it's devastating. First of all, that area is really the watershed for the entire East Coast. So it has ramifications beyond Appalachia. But the folks who have to live under that sort of, really there's no other way to describe it except terrorism. There have just been recent new health studies have come out that show a decrease of anywhere from a half a year to more than 1 year in life expectancy in those counties. The poverty rate, they say the economy depends on coal. The poverty rate, for instance, in the coal-producing counties of Kentucky is 28%, where the national average is right around 15%. Statistic after statistic, I can't even say that word, statistic proves that this sort of the mountaintop removal method of coal mining is destructive. To give you one really strong example, there's a well-being index that's put out by Gallup, and the top five or and it's divided by counties. The top five or six counties, the lowest five or six counties, according to the well-being index, are in Appalachia. In fact, the 435th worst congressional district in well-being index is the congressional district of Hal Rogers in Kentucky, who's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the House of Representatives.
When you talk about things like life expectancy and well-being index, they're kind of statistics and they're numbers, but what does it actually look like in terms of people's lives? Like, how have their lives changed since? I mean, it's hard to imagine that we'd ever be thinking back to the good old days of tunnel coal mining and black lung and things like that. But this seems to be significantly worse.
Well, it's as bad as black lung. Black lung really is a death sentence. What they're doing to the people in Appalachia, for instance, to give you an example of a real-world situation, a lot of people in Appalachia, in the spring is the rainy season, and since they've been doing this mountaintop removal method of coal mining, they've taken all the topsoil. You know, for instance, in West Virginia, they've flattened 400,000 acres. And because of the way the soil has been disturbed and the topsoil's on the bottom and, you know, the rocks and things are on the top, so all this flooding that you've been hearing about in Appalachia is directly due to this mountaintop removal. And a lot of people in certain areas in Appalachia every spring put their kids to bed with their clothes on because they've all picked out escape routes from the flood. Cancer rates are off the wall. For instance, if you were sitting in a home in the mountaintop removal method of region, all of a sudden there'd be an explosion and all the pictures would fall off the wall. Your foundation would crack. There'd be huge cracks appear in the wall. Things like people who've lived there for 7 or 8 generations, their families have lived on the same piece of property. And after 7 or 8 generations, all of a sudden, they turn on their water faucet one day and the water comes out orange. In a lot of cases, the wells have just disappeared because it's cracked the water table and the water goes somewhere else. The people there are just having terrible problems. There are some communities in Appalachia, one in particular, Rawl, that I can think of, R-A-W-L, in West Virginia, that the county medical authority said that it told the residents there to stop using that water even for bathing. So for a long time, they had to have their water shipped in every day.
To what extent do you think that, I mean, people of Appalachia, like it or not, have a reputation as being, whatever, backwoods people, hillbillies, that kind of thing. To what extent does that attitude influence, I don't know if you can answer this question, but, you know, coal companies' decisions to just basically destroy the lives of so many communities? Do they just think that they're subhuman? I mean, what's going on?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and it's something that I think about a lot. One of the things we do is we look at these county demographic scans, and you can just about tell where industry is going to go next, because in those coal-producing counties, there's a functional illiteracy rate of about 25%. The average family income is about $14,000 for a family of four. So these people are really politically disempowered. And that's one of the things that we work on, is to try and convince them that they need to stand up, and because they are the strongest advocates for the effort to try and stop this practice. So it's a real challenge. The people there are great. It's the culture there is so rich, we tend to forget about it. We have this sort of, all over the country, we have this mental image of Appalachia, which just isn't true. Because if you stop and think about it, I mean, bluegrass music comes from Appalachia. And one of the things that we focus on a lot at Appalachian Voices is our mission statement is to protect the ecological and cultural valleys of the central and southern Appalachians. And that is something that we focus on a lot. And, you know, I mean, if anybody who goes to Appalachia and spends any time there and talks to the people and listens to the stories that go way back and hears the music and see how they live, realizes what a rich cultural area it is.
And the effects of this mountaintop removal on that culture, I mean, part of that culture, as I understand it, is really based on the land. Things like gardening, farming, to some extent, hunting, being able to go in the woods, a sense of perhaps more self-sufficiency than a lot of urban people have. That has to be also pretty badly affected by the mountaintop coal removal.
Yeah, every day. One of the ways that people used to supplement their income there was to go hunting for ginseng. And a lot of the areas are just, you know, closed off to that. They also gather wild ramps, which is a kind of a form of wild onion that grows out there. That has been sharply curtailed. In fact, in most of the rivers and creeks in the mountaintop removal mining counties in Appalachia, I mean, you can't eat the fish out of the water. It's so full of contaminants, mercury, heavy metals, that it's just unsuitable for drinking or fishing or doing anything like that.
We're talking to Lenny Combe of Appalachian Voices, who will be here tomorrow at Tipton Hall at 4 o'clock giving a presentation, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I want to get to another question, which is, obviously there are all these effects on human communities, but I can't help but think of all the species who have habitat on these 500 mountains that have been destroyed. What's going on with that?
Well, it's the same thing. The people who used to supplement part of their food from hunting just can't do that anymore. The animals are gone. A lot of the, it's sort of working its way up the food chain. There are several sorts of newts and salamanders that are on the endangered, that have become endangered, and some of the birds, the bot warbler, has become endangered. Where they're doing this is right in the middle of what really is, if you look at a biological map of the U.S., it's a biological hotspot, it's called. And that's one of the things that we worry about, and the people who live there worry about, is the fact that it's just changing the whole ecosystem so that ultimately it will become unsustainable.
I imagine there are also all kinds of social effects that when you have any community that is virtually attacked, I mean, you called it terrorism, from the outside, a lot of other things happen on the inside, family problems, abuse, neglect, and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's, I think, probably one of the most tragic things to see. Because it is sort of a mono economy, there's only one way to really have a job there, and that's something to do with the coal industry. And so the industry has a lot of propaganda that says that people like us and the people in the coal fields, and it's about 60% of them who are opposed to mountaintop removal, the industry is trying to spread the rumor that we are costing jobs when, in fact, we are creating jobs. And I'll certainly talk about that tomorrow. But what it's done to the communities is these people who grew up together, went to school together, go to church together, and now they're fighting because they've totally polarized the communities. And the ones that have some coal mining jobs have been told that they'll lose those jobs. And if the people, you know, if their neighbor who is opposed to mountaintop removal prevails. So it's created situations that it's actually come to violence. And that's something that we worry about a lot. I mean, people have been hurt.
Do you have a vision for other kinds of sustainable economics in that area?
Sure. For instance, we're battling over this permit, which would flatten a mountain near Whitesville, West Virginia, called Coal Mountain. And Coal Mountain, we did a wind study up there, and it turned out to be a Class 4 wind area. And we showed that over a 50-year period, you could produce more kilowatt hours with wind than you could with the coal that is produced there. And there's opportunities like that all over Appalachia. In the case of Coal River Mountain, you know, if they're allowed to proceed with that particular mine, then the wind capacity will be gone because they will have taken about 800 or 900 feet off the mountain.
This is such a classic David and Goliath fight. How have people been coming together to resist? What, if any, successes have you seen?
Well, that's, you know, we've been working really hard for 10 years, and We are a member of a group within Appalachia called the Alliance for Appalachia, and it's 13 member groups, some within the coal fields, and we're just outside of the coal fields. We are Appalachian Voices. It's a regional group. We have created, there are two bills, there's one bill right now and soon to be a Senate bill that would seriously curtail mountaintop removal. And we've been working on this for 10 years, and because of that, the administration is very aware of it and is doing actually the best they can to try and limit this operation. They have finally started to enforce the regulations that are on the books, where for a long time there were regulations, but they just weren't enforced. So as a result of this, there have been 79 permits that are being held by the EPA for further review to make sure that they would be in compliance with the law. I think we are very close to getting this law passed, the Clean Water Protection Act, and that would seriously curtail mountaintop removal. And just the fact that I am talking to you about it right now is something that we're excited about, because we understood immediately, because of the local politics in these areas, we weren't going to get anywhere, and we really had to take this issue nationally. And the fact that there are people in New Mexico and people in California and Arizona and Nevada that care about this is very encouraging to us, and more importantly, the people in Appalachia feel a lot better about it.
Well, you yourself had another similar kind of thing, getting the whole nation interested in the National Arctic Wildlife Refuge and the Arctic in general. That's a place where virtually none of us will ever go, but we still care about it.
Yes, exactly. Well, I myself and thousands of others, I worked on that issue for a long time, and this is very similar. I mean, the issue is very similar. The difference is that when you say the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, it conjures up an image of, you know, spectacular scenery, grandeur, wild country. The problem is when you say Appalachia, it conjures up in most people a much different image. And that's what we're working on very hard to try and change. And that's why we call the presentation that we do, that's why we call it Appalachian Treasures.
So you will be doing this presentation tomorrow at 4 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. It's a free event. Everybody's welcome. Tell us a little bit about what people will be seeing when they go.
Well, they're going to see basically what we try and do is, I will give a history of the issue and sort of where we are with it, but within the visual part of the presentation, you'll see we try and establish a sense of the place, and you can see why it's so important to try and preserve what is left, the mountains that haven't been destroyed. And then, of course, folks will be able to see the threat through pictures and, see how the entire process of this mountaintop removal coal mining takes place and the destruction it causes. And then, of course, there's a large portion of it is through the use of pictures, just getting a chance to really see the people firsthand and see what they have to say about the issue. And I think that is probably the strongest part of it.
Well, I encourage everybody to go. It's tomorrow at 4 o'clock, Tipton Hall. For more information, you can check out the websites of the Santa Fe Watershed Association, Santa Fe Art Institute, Little Globe. They are the co-sponsors of this event. Lenny Combe is with Appalachian Voices. They're on the web at appvoices.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Cheryl. I'm looking forward to tomorrow.
I'd like now to welcome Erica Scharf. She's a filmmaker. Her documentary, Up Heartbreak Hill, will screen at Tipton Hall on Monday, the 19th of March at 6 o'clock, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So this film is about Navajo teenagers and their decisions about what to do with their lives and the what is happening in their lives. How did you come to make this film?
So I actually grew up in New York, and growing up, I had very little contact with modern Native life. There were no Native kids where I lived, and almost everything that, you know, I learned about was sort of in a context of long ago. It was a history lesson. And so I was really curious. There seemed to be a dearth of information about modern Native life, and that was sort of the impetus. And so I had read about some kids on the Navajo Reservation who were these phenomenal runners, and being an amateur runner myself, I was really interested and drawn to that. And so I started making some phone calls to local principals and coaches to see if there was interest in working on a project like this, and the response was really overwhelming. And so that was sort of the beginning. I made a scouting trip out and wound up meeting Thomas and his dad and Tamara and her family, and the film sort of grew from there.
Thomas is a great character. He's a Navajo with a pink mohawk, and he's a runner. And I was thinking as I was watching it, I mean, you know, we're here in New Mexico. Anybody who will be watching this film, many of us have lived here for a long time. And so it's such a different perspective because you are an outsider, and a lot of these folks in the film are probably more familiar to us, even non-Indian people living here in New Mexico. One of the things that I was struck by in the film was the subtext of cultural loss, loss of language, ways of life, a situation where the best choices really often are assimilation, going to college, things like that.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, what was so interesting about the situation that these kids were in was that, on the one hand, their story is really universal. You know, they're high school seniors, and they're facing a huge decision. But for them, that decision is laced with a lot more significance than I think it is for kids in other parts of the country. They're figuring out, how do we balance being, you know, sort of modern mainstream Americans and also holding on to our traditions and our culture. And that's so important to them. And you can see that, you know, they're so connected to their family, to the community, to the land. And so it's really, you know, a unique situation that they're in, where they're sort of trying to figure out, how do we go out and pursue our education, pursue other opportunities, you know, and still remain connected to where we come from. And there's, I think, a lot of pressure on this generation to sort of like go out, get these skills, and then bring them back. And they're trying to figure out, how do we do that? Because they very much want to sort of be the leaders of their community and help figure out, where do we go from here? But that's the large burden for any 17 or 18-year-old kid.
Yeah, there's that question, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, not that we'll necessarily have a chance to follow up, but these kids are in college now. They were in high school when you made the film. What they end up doing, whether they end up coming back to the reservation or whether they end up going out and doing different things with their lives. Do you have any sense of that so far?
No, right now Thomas is in Albuquerque, and Tamara's actually on the reservation, going to school there, and Gabby's living in Arizona. But I think that, you know, the question is still very much up in the air, you know, for them. I think that they all have sort of that push-pull where they want to go out and see what else the world sort of has to offer them, but at the same time, they want to come back. And you know, I know that Thomas and Gabby, even though they're not living on the reservation right now, do travel back, you know, often and see their family, see their friends. You know, I'm not sure where they'll wind up, but I think that they'll always sort of be kind of figuring out how to strike that balance.
The film is called Up Heartbreak Hill, and it screens at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design on Monday, the 19th of March at 6 in the evening, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Erica Scharf is the documentary filmmaker, and you will be here. Is that correct?
That is correct. I will be at the screening and around afterwards for a Q&A and a reception, and I believe that some of the kids will be here as well.
Excellent. Good. Well, we look forward to meeting you. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
And I'd like now to welcome Diane Karp. She is the director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, and she's with us here now on Fridays, speaking of the arts. Welcome, Diane.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Good morning,
good
Santa
morning.
Fe.
Good morning.
There's an amazing amount of good art and music and events that are going on this week. And today, if we can start focusing on that, there are three very, very fine exhibitions that are opening in three different venues. One is the CCA Munoz Waxman Gallery that has an exhibition of two young Santa Fe artists, and it's kind of bringing the outside in. So it's Jamie Hamilton, who works in metal and builds these beautiful suspended sculptures that are all predicated upon tension. So he has a brand new, very large installation and several of his earlier works. And they've paired him with Allison Keough, who is a phenomenal young artist who uses earth materials in order to make art. So there's some installation sculpture. There is beautiful wall painting. And what she does is goes out and finds and creates clay out of the dirt of our environment, out of New Mexico, and then does these exquisite sort of repetitious motion paintings like water, or the way in which sand looks after a flood has gone by or a rain pulse has gone by, and you get those gorgeous little patterns down on the ground. And it opens at 6:30 tonight. And then downtown on Canyon Road, James
Sauer. Okay, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
So an artist, and this is not a negative thing. But
no,
okay,
ask.
An artist makes a piece of dirt on the ground that looks just like how dirt
no,
looks after
no, no,
the
no.
rain.
She does paintings on the wall. So she refines the clay and then thins the clay down to a texture.
But the point is, when it looks the same as it looks on the ground, why not just go outside?
Well, because you can't often find those patterns, especially here. And I don't think that's what she is working toward. For her, it's this sort of patterning of paint on the wall. So each of her large paintings uses a different body part to create gesture. And this, you know, one of them is this sort of reddish clay that is using the forearm. And another one is this very deep chocolatey brown pigment. But the point is that this is about the materials of the earth coming into painting. And that's exactly how early paintings were. The cave paintings are all natural materials. Early painting was natural materials. So the idea of getting away from the created pigments that we have that are manufactured into colors, these are the colors of the earth. So it's paintings that bring that together. Jane Sauer Gallery has a really wonderful show that's opening today called Structures and Surfaces. And it's about churches around the world by Robert Cardinale. And the other, which is just a phenomenal thing, is that the New Mexico Museum of Art has reactivated the idea of alcove exhibitions.
Yes.
Small exhibitions that are a tradition of the museum from time to time.
I love that.
Space got tight. So it's five artists. They're going to do it every 5 weeks. And the curator, who is Mary Scully, is just marvelous. She knows a lot about art. She's got a great eye. She's really sensitive. And for the first time in a very long time, we have a curator from that museum who's going out into the state to look at galleries, to look at studios, to meet artists. She's really reaching out, as opposed to the tradition of sort of waiting until someone brings it to you. So Mary is a gift.
Nice.
And the artists that are involved are Julia Borello, who uses x-rays and MRI films and cuts them into these sort of wonderful, dynamic little forms. Ted Larson, who is a painter, and they're from different places. Julia's from, she teaches at the New Mexico State, down in the southern part of the state. Ted Larson was a painter who has now moved into using salvaged metals to make very beautiful, very thoughtful, simple, minimal sculptures. Jane Lackey, who is a more or less recent arrival, last couple of years to Santa Fe, has done this exquisite body of work on paper, which is about her experience in Japan for 5 months, following the circuits and pilgrimage patterns of, so it's about mapping and moving and notation. And Linda Swanson is also in this exhibition. Linda teaches at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and Linda does these very beautiful graphite drawings on paper that are about space and relationships, hair and the space that hair creates, clouds, feathers. And the last of the artists is David Forlano, who is a metalsmith and a sculptor. And in there are some pieces of jewelry he's done with his partner, as well as some of his paintings. So I think that that's just, you know, an amazing array for Friday night. If you don't want to look at art, Arlen Asher and Michael Glynn and John Trenacosta are going to be up at the Museum Hill Cafe, and they're doing an evening of music that focuses on the great saxophonist Jerry Mulligan. So that's phenomenal. If you don't want music, we've got dance. The Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, which is
Yay.
A point of pride for our city. It is
I
a top-notch, first-rate, brilliant, young dance organization. And the thing that's really marvelous is that tonight they're going to be premiering a piece of choreography by Dorbert De La Cruz, one of their dancers who they brought from Juilliard.
No, it's a new choreographer.
It is. Well, Norbert is, he's a dancer, but he's going to be both dancing and choreographing. And they're premiering this choreographic work. And it should be just a fabulous evening. Other things that are going on, if you want to talk about theater, the Fusion Theater Company is presenting a play at the Armory for the Arts. I think it's called Time Stand Still. And there's Irish dance that's going to be Friday,
yes.
Saturday, Sunday, and that's going to be performed at the, I always call it the Stuart Little, but it's the James A.
The James
Little,
A. Little
Theater at the School for New Mexico School for the Deaf.
Bellissima, so what's it called? Bellissima Irish?
Bellissama.
Bellissama.
Okay, they're not.
They're not Italian.
They're not Italian. You see, they're Irish.
Yeah,
and
but
it begins
both,
with an I.
They're both Catholic.
Well, no, only some of them are Catholic over there in Ireland. That's the core of the problem, you remember.
Oh, yeah.
It's the orange and the green. So one's the Protestants and one's the Catholics, and we're trying to resolve that. In fact, we're keeping it out of this particular
conversation.
keeping it out of this evening of creative performance.
So
that's
sure. tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday, James
yes.
A. Little Theater. It's the 6th annual Rhythm of Fire. And those people, they're so good. And we had them on the air last year. They're lovely.
Yeah. And on Saturday, which is the real day, it's the
St.
Patrick's Day himself. And he obviously didn't come through New Mexico because we got a lot of snakes. So, you know, I'm thinking maybe people are celebrating this in part in a hope that we can sort of have some control over the snakes.
Wherever you're speaking.
We're all over. Out in El Dorado at La Tienda exhibition space, they have some quilts which might be of interest to folks. We've got the High Desert Harpists, which is a phenomenal thing. On Saturday, they're going to be at Collected Works. They brought them before, and it's a group of harpists who are going to be playing Italian. You've got me started. They're going to be playing classical Celtic music, and that's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it runs all through the afternoon. And then you can leave there, and at 4 o'clock, go over to Tipton Hall at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, where we're going to be screening Appalachian Treasures. And that's a...
It's not just a screening. It's a multimedia presentation.
I was just going to say that exactly.
Which we talked about, if you were listening, dear,
exactly.
10 minutes ago.
And so it's a whole group of organizations in town, the Art Institute, Little Globe, the Rail Yard Stewards, the Watershed, the Vista Corps volunteers, and they're all focused on helping us to understand the powerful destructiveness of mountaintop removal for coal mining so that we can get rid of coal. On that topic...
Or leave it in the ground.
So we can get rid of coal as a source of electrical energy. Stop burning it as a fuel. Yeah, leave it where it is. There's a beautiful mural that's another collaboration in town that's going up on the side of Warehouse 21. It's that huge wall that faces away from Guadalupe Street. And it's a combination of the new energy economy, the earth care core of young youth, the youth allies who are our future stewards, the Santa Fe Art Institute, and Warehouse 21. And it's done by Ann Stavely and John Santos. And it's a project in process. It'll be worth it for everybody to go over there. It's about replacing coal with solar energy. So the core of it is called Soul, Not Coal, S-O-L, and is just remarkable. I really recommend highly that everybody get over there and take a look at it. So as we move on...
I say one?
You bet.
How about Axel Contemporary?
Oh, yes.
Have you seen their picture van thing?
Not only have I seen it, we've talked about it. And,
oh, that's right. I got my picture taken. You did, too.
I did, too. And it really is a wonderful way of creating a photographic record of Santa Fe that doesn't come from some single-minded purpose. It really is about being in places that are not typically art places and letting the people in those places step into the van and
get their picture taken.
Get their picture taken and become part of the record. And everybody's invited to bring something that matters to them. So,
well, on March 21st, which I believe is Tuesday of next week, is that right? March 21st, from 2:30 to 6, the students at the New Mexico School for the Arts will be exhibiting their video animations inside the Axel Contemporary Mobile Gallery, which is basically a van. It looks like a kind of large post office van.
Or a bread truck. It's kind of like
a bread truck.
Like a bread truck, which I like because that's everyday materials.
Bread. So both students and visitors can join the teacher there and movable types, Kyle Dury, and set and print texts in the movable type mobile letterpress studio.
Yep.
So if you've ever wondered about how letterpress printing works, check it out. It's free, and it's at the New Mexico School for the Arts, 275 East Alameda in Santa Fe.
They're
going to be parked in the north side of the building close to Paseo, across from the Travel Bug. You can go to axelart.com.
Great. On Sunday, there's an amazing array of really, really fine stuff going on. The ongoing performances by Aspen Santa Fe Ballet and Bellissima Irish Dance. But on Sunday at 1 p.m. at Site Santa Fe, Lucy Lippard and Seth Siegelaub are going to be having a Skype conversation. And Seth Siegelaub is actually at the core of the big exhibition sequence that's going on at Site. He was someone who tried to get art away from the precious object and create something that was simply a record. And that should be an amazing, amazing conversation. So I recommend it highly. On Monday, you've got a lot going on. Monday the 19th. First of all, you have the screening of Up a Heartbreak Hill, where...
So that means the 21st is not Tuesday,
but Wednesday. It's going to be Wednesday, yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, on your press releases, please write the day. Thank you very much.
So we have Erica Scharf coming in. She's going to be there with a lot of the young people who were in the film, their families. So it should be a very interesting evening. And I recommend that you all join us. On Tuesday, there's tons going on in Santa Fe. We got the Swingle Singers there at the Lensic. And for those of you who don't know who the Swingle Singers are, they were the first group to make a cappella voice and a cappella performance really hip and cool. And if you know...
It wasn't the Whiffin' Poofs?
No, it was actually... The Whiffin' Poofs were kind of stuck up at Yale, and there's probably many meanings to what I just said, but the Swingle Singers were an international success, and they toured all over the world, and they're kind of at the core of the new television show Glee that has made glee clubs and chorus and singing kind of hip again, which is wonderful, especially as just voice, as a cappella.
Certain people in my life will not let me watch that show.
Yes, I can understand.
I like it.
Also on Tuesday is, so that the Swingle Singers will be at 7:30, but on Tuesday, if you want to do something different, at 6:30 at the James A. Little Theater, the Lannan Foundation, God bless the Lannan Foundation, is bringing us a literary event with environmental activist Christopher Williams, who's going to give a talk very positive, very sort of promising about the fact that we're not done yet. The environment is not dead. If we can make some substantive changes, he really can demonstrate. He's a professor and of chemistry and physics, and he can talk very powerfully about the changes that will be needed in order to save the environment and save our culture and our people as a species.
Well, you know what really helped me a lot? A couple of years ago, you, Diane, and the Santa Fe Art Institute had an artist here named Patricia Johansson who made, her art was making these built like ponds, and around the Dallas Museum she constructed a beautiful pond with little bridges and walkways and plants and
out
stuff like that.
Out of a devastated mud hole.
Yeah, out of a
polluted mud hole.
Polluted old parking lot mud hole dump waste thing.
And cleaned up the water and made it an environment.
And next thing you know, the snapping turtles have come back.
Exactly.
And for some reason, that image of the snapping turtles in the middle of Dallas made me feel into like this sense of hope inside that give the earth just half a chance and it will be re-inhabited.
And in fact, that's very true. The earth has a remarkable way of healing itself. In fact, there's a recent report that came out on the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And the statement that was made was that ultimately, no matter what man did, the recovery, to the extent that it's been recovered, there's still a huge amount of oil there, was the result of natural forces, that man had very little to do and may have actually even slowed down the natural forces. But Patricia will be back.
Oh, good.
We're doing a major exhibition for work in 2014.
Oh, wonderful. Another animal-related thing is that Felines and Friends has bouquets of kitties just waiting to be picked as your companion. This week's featured cat is Marina. She's a beautiful young girl with a short coat and brown tabby markings with spirals on her fur. She's sweet and playful and would make anyone a wonderful companion. And if you're interested in adopting this kitty or any kitty, call 505-316-2281 or go to fandfnm.org. That stands for Felines and Friends of New Mexico.org. fnfnm.org, or write to askfelinesandfriends@yahoo.com.
On Wednesday, the 21st, besides the event that you just mentioned, in concert is Good Old War, and it's a folk pop trio that comes from Philadelphia. Yoo-hoo! Go Philadelphia! And they're amazingly fine acoustic guitar, strong voices. It should be a wonderful evening at Santa Fe Soul Stage and Grill, which is a great addition to the musical venues here in Santa Fe. So that's on Wednesday night at 7:30. The other thing that's going on at 7 p.m. at the Lensic is the Banff Mountain Film Festival, International Environmental Adventure Films. And as we move on, do you have anything else on Wednesday before I move?
Oh, I don't.
You don't do it that way.
I'm
okay.
Not linear.
The 22nd, Thursday, in concert at the Pink Pepto Bismol.
The Scottish Rites.
I can never remember what it's called. Is Native American Inspirations New Mexico Composers. It is a wonderful collection of Native composers, Raven Chacon, Peter Garland, Louis Ballard, and it's being performed by pianist Emmanuel Arcioli. It should be quite wonderful, and it's a collaborative thing that's done between this New Mexico Composers Group and the O'Keeffe Museum's exhibition of Jean Quick Dessy Smith.
And I think I'm going to get one of the composers on the air next week.
Raven Chacon is part of a Native American art collaborative, and it's called Post Commodity. We have brought them out before. Raven is just brilliant.
At Collected Works Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock, Destiny Allison will be talking about her book, Shaping Destiny, A Quest for Meaning in Art and Life. And then tomorrow, I think you already talked about High Desert Harpists.
Yes.
On St. Patrick's Day, and then Josh Gonze, The Streets of Santa Fe, a walking tour, but
It doesn't, they haven't told me what the date is of that, so ladies and gentlemen, we will get back to you on that.
Well, there are a couple other amazing things going on Thursday. On Thursday evening at the screen is the New Mexico film documentary that was made by Brent Morris and David Schweitzer, and it's about the quality, the richness, and the diversity of film that comes out of New Mexico. So that should be a really interesting evening with a Q&A with the two directors at 7 p.m. And if you'd like to meet people that make art, both visual art and literary art, the Santa Fe Art Institute has its open studios for March.
Yay.
On Thursday evening from 5 to 6:30, and then you can move right on to the screen at 7 p.m. or on to the Native American Inspirations New Mexico Composers.
And just in case anybody wants to do super Irish stuff, the Legal Tender restaurant sent me a notice saying that it's St. Patrick's Day, Lucky St. Patrick's Day, this Saturday. And so they're going to have all kinds of Irish specials, including Irish desserts and shamrock sugar cookies and things like that. So and they also have tonight the Buffalo Nickel Band, two musicians from West Texas and two native Santa Feans. And tomorrow, the Tornadoes dance into the night with classic rock and country. That's all at the Legal Tender in Lamy, which I just discovered a few weeks ago, and the food was so good.
Really?
Oh, God.
That's great.
It was amazing.
That's great to know. I mean, if you're going to go out to Lamy to listen to music, it's always nice to have something to munch on.
And it was nice atmosphere. Everything was good. This Saturday morning, tomorrow, right here on KSFR, Camp Lovewave brings you Chemtrail Guru, Cliff Carnicom, to discuss the elephant in the room or the elephant in the sky.
The elephant in the room or the elephant in the sky? Is that sort of clouds being brought into the interior environment?
You'll have to listen and
is
find out.
Is it a dog? Is it an elephant?
It's not a dog.
So St. Patrick's Day, let's talk about that.
Let's talk about how tonight Santa Fe's hottest Latin dance night. And last week I went salsa dancing for the first time in months. And
did you hurt anything?
No, it was wonderful.
Excellent.
The Lodge from 9 o'clock on, 21 and over, salsa, bachata, merengue, et cetera, et cetera. More information, 603-7118. The main thing is there is salsa in Santa Fe Friday nights. And there's things in other parts of the week, but this is like hot DJ salsa.
That's fabulous.
And that's a good thing.
There was a time when there was an array of places that you could go and dance in Santa Fe, and for whatever reason, a lot of those venues closed down.
Yeah, I don't know what happened in the El Dorado. They had a nice little dance and music place right in that main central area.
Yes.
In the back, and I've heard that they weren't doing that anymore. I don't know what's going on there. Shona Slovakia World Fusion Dance Band tonight from 9 to 12:30 in the morning, and we've had them on the air. They're way, way fun and fun to dance to.
Fun to listen to, fun to dance to, fun to watch.
And on Sunday, Michael Combs, songster busker at Upper Crust Pizza from 6 to 9, joined by Eagle Star, father-daughter folk country duo from 7 to 8 in the evening. That's this coming Sunday at Upper Crust Pizza, which is also great fun. Don't forget David Geist Cabaret at Pronzo. Always great fun to go listen to David Geist.
And take a moment to step back in history.
That's right. Go back in time.
Feel the feelings of this of the past, right here in the future.
Years ago, I worked for a high-tech company, and one of our engineers came up with the slogan for the company, Yesterday's Technology, Tomorrow. Diane Karp is director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. And she is with us on Friday morning. Speaking of the arts, Diane, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for making all the arts available on the radio, Mary Charlotte. We love KSFR.
Yay. And you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email is radiocafe@ksfr.org. And I'm on Twitter at Radio Cafe MC. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. Thanks, by the way, to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today and every Friday. She's fabulous. And after that, jazz a la carta with Ricardo Perez and Helga Ancona in the middle Brazilian hour. Hasta la vista, baby.